Welcome to Holen Village. Today in the incredible Creekside Room, the speaker is Chuck Huff, and he will be speaking on conflict, good news and bad news. So let's listen in on Chuck.
My name is Chuck Huff. A lot of people call me Chucky Huff. That's just fine if you'd like to do that. In the South, being called diminutive like Chucky is a sign of closeness, not a sign of, you use that when you want. It's a sign of being close to somebody instead of a sign of making light of them. So if you want to call me Chucky, that's fine. I got Chucky because my daddy was Charlie, so they couldn't do that one. I'm a social psychologist. What that means is that I study how people interact with each other and get along with each other, and how that works itself out both in social perception, that is, how I perceive you, and say, gosh, what a nice hat, you must be a really cool fellow. And think of, you know, and how we make inferences like that. I have one to play. And how that social perception then feeds our interaction with each other. So, you know, we perceive somebody, we see that they act in a certain way, and we then interact with them in another way. Last week I did a whole bunch of stuff on social perception. This week, partly because of Christine Carlson's Bible study that I went to last week, I decided to do a whole week on social conflict. Now, don't presume that that meant we fought all through her Bible study. What it meant is that she did some of the parts of Romans where Paul was encouraging the Romans to try to find common ground with each other. Try to find the things in Jesus Christ that held them together rather than the things that pulled them apart, like whether they were vegetarians or eating meat, that sort of stuff. And the resonance to of people to that issue made it seem to me like folks might really be interested in a series on social conflict. So I changed my mind and I've redone all my notes and rushed through a couple overheads. So here we are. But one thing I do want to say, it's not quite as, people are not as likely to make the inference when I talk about social conflict as they do when I do other stuff. I'm not a trained clinical psychologist. So I'm not really trained to help people with their problems, their personal problems. I'm a nice guy. If you want to talk to me, I'll be glad to talk. But I can't. But I wouldn't want to even represent myself as somebody who can help people with their personal problems. So, one other point in terms of the kind of thing that I do here. I'd like to get us willing to think more complexly about social conflict. So instead of thinking about us and them, I want to show you some models today that allows us to think a little bit differently. Instead of thinking in black and white, instead of thinking I can either fight them or I can't, I want to talk about a whole variety, later in the week, a whole variety of strategies that are available to people who are in a conflict situation. So I'm not going to give you easy answers to go back and fix your church, because I have yet to be able to fix any churches. But I do hope to give you some tools to use as you think about conflict. One of the ways I want to get you to think more complexly about conflict today is to try to convince you that conflict is good. That it's a good thing, and it's useful for us. We shouldn't shy away from it. Now, in a little while, I think you'll understand what I mean, but sometimes, particularly my undergraduates, find that a very strange point of view, because they spend a lot of their time backing up from conflict. They don't want to deal with it, because it is uncomfortable. It's not fun. It provokes anxiety. One of the ways that I hope to make it easier for you to see the good in conflict and to be willing to engage in it is by helping you to think more complexly about it, so that you'll see that, well, it doesn't have to be this evil thing. Now, for my first overhead. Oh, boy. It's almost been focused too. For people who care about justice issues, conflict clearly has got to be a good thing, right? Because it nourishes social change. If you want to change the world, if you want even to change the way your local community works, you got to do conflict. Now, conflict, when I use the word, I don't mean people duking it out. What I mean is people who think that they disagree with regard to their interests. That is, you want one thing and I think I want another. Now, I set it up that way using thoughts rather than the actual stuff, whether we actually disagree. Because really, it's perception that runs conflict. If I think you and I disagree, I'm going to act differently to you than if I think that we agree on something. I almost slipped into saying I think we get along, and I want to say, no, that's not. We can get along and have a difference in interests. So if you perceive a difference in interests, if you think that they want something and you want something else, often the only way to get it is to engage in conflict. And if you know how to do conflict and approach it well, you can get a voice in a community. I can't guarantee that. You know, don't sue me if it doesn't work. Because there are powerful interests that work against you. Now, it sounds kind of silly to say the second one, which is that conflict helps people to agree. Now, let me try to convince you of that. Conflict helps people to agree because if we didn't engage in conflict, we wouldn't know where we disagreed. And we might not be motivated to change our minds. So conflict motivates us to get something done. And if you do conflict and resolve a conflict, instead of simply one side winning, if you resolve a conflict, then in fact that conflict has helped you to agree with the other person or with the other group. This is why I say you shouldn't shy away from conflict, because if in fact you perceive that there are differences and can approach it in a way that allows you to solve problems together, then it's possible to come out the other side of conflict with agreement. And that then suggests that it helps to produce group unity. And it's sort of a surprising thing to say that if you want your church to be more close together, it needs to engage in conflict. But in fact, if you want groups to be more close together, they do need to do that. Now, they don't just need to get out guns and go for it. What they need to do is to think carefully about how they're going to resolve their difference of opinion and their differences on issues, And if they come to a successful conclusion of that, it produces unity between the two sides. Now, it also produces unity within the two sides. I feel closer to people who have been on, quote, my side. But it can produce unity between the two parties that are in conflict. All you have to do is think back through history, international history, about the variety of nations that used to be enemies that are now close friends. And it was through some of the working out of that conflict. It wasn't simply from forgetting the conflict. It was through some of the working out of that conflict that they were able to become allies rather than enemies. Now, I painted kind of a rosy picture of conflict. I do want to say some of these things down here. Conflict is a very dangerous thing. Because it's really an easy setup for misperception. And I want to talk later in the week more about how misperception runs in conflicts. But if I think that you disagree with me, you're different from me now. And you've got different motivations. And it's possible even for me to think that you must be evil to think that way. I call that the conspiracy theory. And I'm going to unpack that conspiracy theory a little bit later, but the conspiracy theory in short is that, well, clearly the world is the way I see it. You start there. Clearly I'm seeing the world right. You disagree with me about the way the world is. You must be perverse to disagree, because you must see it the way I see it too. Because that's the way it is. So the reason you see it differently has to be because you're weird, not because you might be able to see the world differently. That there might be two different sides. So it's a very easy setup for us to believe that the other people are in it because they're evil. This evening I'm going to have a slideshow of slides and posters for different sides in wars. And what you'll see is how we have demonized the enemy across a whole variety of conflicts. It is very easy in conflict to escalate. That is, to go to stronger and more powerful tactics to try to get your way. Part of this is because people don't think really complexly about the conflict, and they only think, well, either I win or I lose, so I better get out the guns. And part of it is because this simple thinking about conflict is driven by our misperceptions. I see you do a thing, and since you're on that side, you must have done it to hurt me. So now I'm offended. And I will do something to defend myself. So I defend myself, but you don't think I'm defending myself. You think I'm hurting you. And here we go, off to the races. The intensity of conflict and its complexity often makes it difficult to think and feel clearly about things. I suspect this is the case with any of you who are participating in discussions on the statement on sexuality. Do I have that phrase right? I'm not a Lutheran, so I don't know the jargon. Is it statement on sexuality?
Human sexuality.
Oh, human sexuality. Okay. So we'll leave out the other folks. We'll let them do what they want. And you see the intensity of the emotions on both sides of this conflict. And that intensity makes it difficult for people to think clearly. It's very much easier to fall into these misperceptions and to escalate. And it's much easier to confuse all of your motivations because you're way too busy fighting to think clearly. So it's important both to avoid the bad things and to get the good things about conflict. It's important to think about it more complexly. And I want to start with just a little bit of groundwork today. I don't want to go too long on two things that y'all want to talk about. I'll start with just a little bit of groundwork on making things more complex. Does that work? Can everybody see that? The usual model about how we think about and feel about each other is this one up here at the top, this line, which is that either we're concerned for us or we're concerned for them. And that's the standard way we think about things. We think about Republicans versus Democrats. We think it's fascinating the dualities that we fall into in our culture. There is, by the way, some interesting research about how parents think about their children, depending upon whether there's two or more than two. If there's two of them, they are constantly being compared. Well, Johnny does this, but Susie does that. If there's three of them, you don't get as much of that comparing of one and the other. And it's very easy for us to fall into this dualistic mode of thought. What I want to do is to take those arrows and bend them and say it's possible for me to be greatly concerned about my outcomes. I care a great deal about what I get out of it. But it's also possible at the same time for me to be greatly concerned about your outcomes. This is, I think, what we're supposed to do when we're married to each other. Be concerned about both of us. I hope it's what we do in the church. Paul talks about that again in that section in Romans. I was saying you want to be concerned both about your own spiritual growth and about the spiritual growth of the other people. So if you're concerned a great deal about yourself and concerned a great deal about the others, sort of logical thing to do is to problem solve. Right, you want to work something out that gets both of you what you need. If you're concerned a great deal for them, and it's not an issue that really is that important to you, Paul talks about this when he talks about giving in on particular issues and said, well, fine, then just don't eat meat when you're around them. Then what you do is yield and say, that's okay, fine, we'll go to Valley Fair. You know, I just won't get on the rides that make me throw up. If you don't have a great deal of concern for their outcomes and you do have a great deal of concern for yours, why then you get out the guns. Then you contend. Now, later in the week, I want to try to convince you that contending is not always getting out the guns. In fact, a lot of what Martin Luther King did was contending. He escalated lots of conflicts, but he was nonviolent in the way he contended. It's kind of a weird sentence, but that's the way he did it. Gandhi was the same way. It's possible to be nonviolent and to contend. And of course, if it doesn't matter very much at all, you'll just go on a hike.
You know.
That's good.
It doesn't matter to you and you. Now, one of the things, I didn't do this partly because it would have made it a much more complex diagram, is we're doing this from our perspective. My concern for me and my concern for you. Now, but you have to run another model too, because there's at least one other person in a conflict. So you have to think about their concern for them and their concern for you in order to get to them. You know, then the overhead would be in, I don't know, four dimensions. It would be a mess. You have a layer maybe for each person. Dear God. But if you can think about who cares for whom in this fashion, instead of in this sort of linear fashion, it makes it a little easier to think, well, what kind of strategies are available for me? What kind of strategies might they use? It also makes it a little easier for you to get rid of some of the misperceptions. Because if it's clear that they, because if you're running on this model at the top, where if concern for them is different from concern for us, and it's clear that the other person cares a great deal about that issue, well, the logical inference is they don't care at all about you. That's if you use this model. It makes a lot of sense to think that if they care a great deal, they don't care at all about you. But it is possible to do it this way. I have often started out negotiations among people by laying out this kind of groundwork and making sure that people knew on both sides of it that people on both sides cared about each other rather than sort of immediately getting down to brass tacks. Well, let me give you another cool overhead. That's not it. Where'd it go? Oh my. Well, it must be on the floor in the office up there. We can do this pretty easily, actually, since it's a small group. It's got big print, you can see it. We often think in terms of benefit, too, as this. Now here, instead of talking about concern, we're talking about solutions, right? Whether a particular solution will work for you or work for them. And very often we fall into the easy trap of saying, something that's good for you must be bad for me. And something that's good for me must be bad for you. I like to throw in psycho jargon every once in a while just for fun. In psychology, we call this a zero-sum game. Right? It means that anything that's added on your side takes away from my side. Well, it is a lot easier, and act for a minute, and I'll turn the microphone around so they don't get mad. For a minute, let me go draw on the board over here this benefit model, because it's important to play with it in your mind as you're going through a conflict. Thank you, sir. If on the bottom axis here, we talk about benefit to us, and if on the other axis, we talk about benefit to them. Now remember, they are running this model too. All right, so it gets more complex than just this two-dimensional thing. It is possible to imagine, now that we've bent this, instead of having it on one dimension, now that we've bent it into a two-dimensional model, it's possible to imagine solutions that are way out here, that is, that are of great benefit to us and of benefit to them. It's also possible to imagine solutions that, God forbid, you would both agree about, that you both hate, and that are of no benefit to either of you. And then, of course, there are solutions all over in this space. Part of being a creative negotiator is getting these dots in this space and figuring out where they are, finding solutions and determining whether they fall to the benefit of us and them. Now, I want to add one more thing, and just because I draw it on the board, I don't want you to think that it always goes there. But we can add some dotted lines, and these dotted lines are where we are willing to draw the line with regard to our own benefit, and where we think, now remember, we're talking about thinking here about the other, where we think they're willing to draw the line. And of course, they're running this same model. You need aspirin after you do this for a while. But it is possible, of course, to move these lines around. If I think that I can get more from them, I might move my line up. This is no surprise to those of you who go to garage sales. Right? So you do this in garage sales all the time. That's not no surprise. It looks complex, but it's precisely the kind of thing that you do. What often happens then in a conflict is we look at the, I call this a solution space. We see what's out there. We see where people's lines are, and then we talk to each other and we figure out if we can come up with a deal. And if we can't come up with a deal, well, then it's back to the board. And when you go back to the board, there's a whole lot of things that you can do. You can attempt to get them to move their line down. You can move your line down, right? Because what you want to do is to try to get more space up here. What you want to try to do is to get more space up in this upper quadrant. And if they'll move their line down, you'll get it. You can also go out looking more carefully to see if there might be more solutions out there that you overlooked the first time. Then you go back to the table and you talk to each other again. But both of these different models that I've been showing you are models that take this simple dichotomizing of the way we think about conflict, which is us versus them, our benefit versus their benefit, concern for me versus concern for you, and turns them into two-dimensional models and says, look, it's possible for us to find things that are high on both of these dimensions. For many people, this is just an amazing revelation, that it might be possible for there to be something that's good for us both. Part of the reason that perception runs that way is because the emotions get high. And because you're angry, you don't want to do anything that makes them happy. So you're back to that one-dimensional solution. And we can talk about all of that stuff too. But this is just a beginning, a grounding for thinking about the complexity of, I'll go back to these later in the week, for thinking about the complexity of conflict. And we now have a fair amount of time for discussion, things that y'all want to talk about.
Or we can go sit in the sun.
Yes, sir.
It's an ideal world where we both can see the wisdom of problem solving so that both people benefit or maximize.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do when you get to a hard-headed redneck who can't see squarely at all and doesn't want to move or budge and decides anything you say is absolutely unacceptable?
You're talking about my daddy now. This is, and later, again later in the week, I want to talk much more carefully about why contending is a useful strategy. I mean, the title for that session is Why Escalation is Reasonable. That is, in fact, what you want to do when you what you want to do to escalate is to try to sort of get those folks' attention. One of the things that escalation does is it convinces other people that you care deeply. Sometimes they don't know. Sometimes they may just be trying you out to see if they can get what they want. The escalation is a very uncomfortable thing to do. So you have to weigh for your sits of doing escalation while, on the other hand, the cost sort of psychologically to you and to your relationship with the other person. Now, it is also possible, and this is an even more delicate balance, it's also possible to do escalation in a conflict, to contend, while doing your best to help the other person perceive that you feel like you have to act this way. Did that make sense? So what you're trying to do is to get them to say, oh, they are contending against me because they feel like they have to, not because they're evil. They are contending against me because this issue is so important to them that they feel like it is worth whatever strategy they have just used. Some of the models, in fact, that we use of attempts to reduce escalation involve threats of escalation. Now, oddly enough, because you want to say, look, I'd love to work with you. I think there's some solutions that we can come up with that we'd both be very happy with. Let me show you some of them. But I got to tell you that it's so important to me that if we can't come to a solution, I'm going to have to take the matter into my own hands. And very often what that will do is people in the South will go, "Hoo, hello," and begin to think. Now, but it's easy when you do that. Instead of trying this balancing act I was just talking about, it's easy just to say, "All right, you're going to be that way about it. Let's go," and get out the guns. So I think it's possible to do that. So I'm for escalation. Because in the right circumstances, escalation can get you what you want and get them what they want. Which sounds a little funny, I know, but you can use the escalation to motivate the other people to problem solve. That's one way. That's a sort of direct way. There are some other avenues, bringing in third parties, those sorts of things. Was that?
In other words, if you have a hard head that at work, what you need to do is catch their attention, 2x4 and tackle the mule's head.
That's
approach,
right.
Saying, you know, I don't want to do this, but this is what I have to do because you need to realize how
that's right.
You feel about it. Now, short of that, let's see if we can find a solution.
That's right. And you might not even, and it's possible to phrase it as not doing it to them, but doing it for you. You know, so that, and it's still an outcome they wouldn't like. One of the dangerous things about sessions on conflict is that people can leave it with all of these cool tools, thinking that now they can go and fix things. Yeah, and if your daddy is anything like mine, even escalation may not work. It may simply be time to make a hard choice. So, you know, there are no solutions that work for the person who is determined to get their own way and cares nothing about you. If there were, I'd be making a lot more money.
but even the threat of a hard decision will motivate people to move.
That's right. That's right.
This is serious enough to me that if we don't talk about it, or if we don't find some ground, I'm going to invest.
And particularly if they care about you.
Yeah.
Or care about your relationship, or care about the church that you're in. It's important, though, when you do that kind of escalation, to do your very best to keep the lines of communication open and to make sure that they know why you're doing it, instead of simply just to say, all right, here we go, off to the races. Partly because in escalation, this is one of my favorite bits of psycho jargon. After very severe bouts of escalation, we often fall into what we have called hostile autism, which is that I'm hostile against you, and I'm only going to talk to myself, and I'm not going to talk to you at all. And then it's impossible for me to change, and for you to change. So that's the danger of escalation. And when I talk about how escalation is reasonable, we'll talk some more. We'll unpack that a little bit more. But this is why when I teach this course at St. Olaf, I have to beg my students to escalate, because they're so afraid of it. And they ought to be afraid, but they ought not to be terrified.
Are they afraid of escalating, or are they afraid of conflict resolution, and the more natural reaction is just to avoid the problem entirely? Escalation is one of the things that they want to avoid. They want to avoid the whole process.
They want to avoid being thought of as pushy or nasty. And to them, that's particularly at this time of their lives, that's a very big deal. They're trying to make friends in college. And they find it very difficult to say anything. This is why I think relativism runs rampant on college campuses, just because it's easier to say, well, that's your opinion. Instead of trying to work out a way to disagree creatively. And that's part of what I think I want to do this week, is to talk about ways to disagree creatively. Without some of these underlying assumptions of stuff that's good for one and is bad for the other. Yes?
You just touched upon such a sore point, such a critical point. The churches in general, and I don't say the church, but individual congregations in general in this country, it's probably just, I don't know, this way everywhere, but it just seems like when I look at the kinds of issues that are dealt with here and that are dealt with, you know, even by edicts, when they have the national synodical conventions and this kinds of thing, mm-hmm. They vote on these things and they argue over these things, and it's like it's removed from the congregational level, where in fact all the bodies are, and that's where the people should be dealing with this thing. And I just get so frustrated because it always comes back to the bottom line, which is survival. And so the pastor very often is married and has a family, And so his survival is dependent upon keeping his job, more or less. Not really, but you know what I'm saying. And so he has to keep the waters fairly smooth. And then in the people in the congregation, it's the same thing. If you stir them up too much, unless they all could have something like this, maybe, that would make them see differently, they just leave. It's just easier to leave if you get mad. And we all see it all the time. People just leave. Well, of course, if the people leave and you're not taking in the money, keep your church going and you pay your pastor. And so, when you mention relativity, I mean, it's just, we cannot, nothing is brought up that makes anyone upset. We'll just keep the water smooth. And what you have is like a lukewarm milk toast religion. And it drives me crazy.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I would be willing to make that final conclusion that you, I was with you all the way up to the milk toast.
Maybe that's too strong a term.
Because I think it is possible for us to take some issues, and Paul tries to do this in Romans, right? And say, look, folks, these issues just aren't that important. But what is important is the fact that we are all heirs, co-heirs with Christ, and that we are all members of the church because of God's grace.
That has to start it. That has to be, you know, that coming out then. You know, what I see, at least in our congregation, is that the hard issues are never dealt with. They really, I think, bring you into a closer relationship with each other and also with Christ. That, you know, and so it keeps the people from having the depth of faith that they could have because they won't deal.
Oh, I see your point. I think that's a very good one, which is that many of these issues that we deal with in the church are central to how we feel about ourselves. A lot of the sexuality thing. And because we are afraid of conflict, we don't address them. And therefore, we stunt our own spiritual growth.
And the growth of the congregation, the spirituality of the congregation.
Because if we could work out a way to address them creatively rather than destructively, we could, both as individuals and as a church, grow. And I think, I think this fear of conflict does keep us from doing that. Which is why, after being in Christine's Bible study, I decided to do this thing on social conflict. Thinking that we could think more carefully about how to do conflict so that we, you know, it would be wonderful, I think, to have a discussion on the sexuality draft, human sexuality draft. I want to make sure we get that right. And to have people who were on, at least on one issue, there's two sides. The people who are on both sides be willing to sit out and say to each other at the beginning, you know, I care greatly about my outcomes, and here's why it's so important to me. But since you're part of the body of Christ, I care about your outcomes too. And let's work out a way that we can talk about this without having to hate each other. And we might still disagree. I think that would be a great step forward just to start those conversations that way. But then again, for some people, it's precisely about who's in and who's out. And that makes it harder. Other comments? Thoughts? Yes?
I was thinking about this, these two situations were both with physicians. And I, you know, being a nurse, one of them was with a personal contact where I was working with this physician, and he was being rude and treating me, you know, in a real degrading way. So I just told him, you know, because he had everybody afraid of him.
Right.
And so I took the risk and I told him I didn't like the way he was treating me, and also I documented it. And
escalation. I'm just labeling that escalation, documenting his behavior as a form of escalation.
Yeah.
See, I've got this.
Yeah, and I documented his behavior, and then the next day, and I told him that I did it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day he came in and he said, "Would you be able to help me?" I mean, he's like, just have this respect for me. And it was like, after that, him and I had this different relationship. And, well, I mean, so I think that because there was a lot of conflict. But then I had another situation where I was the patient in the emergency room at the hospital where I worked, and this doctor, I was pretty sick, and so, you know, then you're kind of pretty powerless. And so I was so angry about this situation that took place, and how the treatment that I received and so forth. And this, I'm still mad about it. I'm just thinking about this. Now, I wrote a letter to the president of the hospital where I worked. Actually, I wrote it to the doctor, and then I sent carbon copies to the president, to the director of the group. Mm-hmm. And I never, ever got a response. And that's the part that still, it was like the secretary of the group called me up on the phone and said, told me that she received my letter, and that did I have anything else I wanted to talk about? I said, well, whatever I put in the letter was what
I wanted to talk about.
And I never got a letter or any comment, and I'm still mad. So my question is, how much more then do you do after?
That's
one
a
writes
question.
A letter, and you know, you want some kind of response.
Yes. Just for fun, I want to stick that in this model. If you look at their response, they were concerned a lot about them and weren't concerned very much about you. But it doesn't work out the way this says, because they were in power. And if you're in power, avoiding is often a wonderful strategy. That's all that feels to the powerless a lot like contending. But it's a low cost strategy for them. They just have to ignore you until you become unignorable. You were going to say something, I'm sorry.
You haven't got the mule's attention yet.
Yeah, well,
you need something to mule, and so the next step would be
with the American Medical
letter,
yeah.
You write the same letter to the chair of the board or all board members of that institution. And if that doesn't work, then you send it to, for example, a letter to the editor and or to the regional accrediting organization for the hospital, okay? And that's contending, but it will eventually get the mule's attention.
Well, and part of it depends upon how important it is to you.
That's it. It took a lot of energy just to write the one letter.
That's
and
right.
Write it in a way where I had I always have somebody else read my letters. Because they say,
right.
You know, well, is this what you're saying? So
right.
You know, what I think I'm saying might not be necessarily what I want to say. But it's a lot of work.
That's right.
But you know, so you have to really keep pursuing these, you know, until you finally get to that point. And now I'm still mad about it. So it's still not resolved.
Yeah, but it might be, you know, better for you to be still mad about it, but not dog tired. Whereas if you continued working it out, some people spend their lives trying to get the establishment's attention and never succeed, and it burns them out, and it ruins their life, and it And part of it then is a choice for the person who's in the conflict about, for them, what is the most healthy thing.
It's the serenity prayer, isn't it?
That's part of it.
The courage,
that's right.
To know what I can change, the courage to change things.
And, you know, I did the same thing with an even larger bureaucracy in Minnesota, which is the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And God, trying to get engineers to change is worse than trying to get doctors to change, I think. You're an engineer? Okay. As we'll go back to one of my earlier sessions and say, some of my best friends are engineers.
He deals with bureaucracy.
Okay. And they were going to build an old-style 1950s four-lane highway through Northfield, which is a small community. And I worked with the group that was against it for about a year and a half, and the city council was not interested. They wanted the old-style highway. And I finally said, I don't have the energy to put into this conflict anymore. And I got, there were some folks in that group who were mad at me today because I dropped out, but I decided that I just did not have the time to continue that and to be, you know, a psychologically healthy person. I was not going to stay up all night writing letters and folding brochures and making phone calls. So you just have to pick and choose. Again, there's not easy answers to these. You just have to, but you've got to, you know, you have described, I think, a classical problem that folks have in social conflict.
Well, one of the other things that I've noticed, and I think, I don't know, I can't really say for men, but I can say for some women that I know, is they complain about it. People complain about the problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they go around and tell everybody else. But I felt like at least I did something when I wrote, sat down and wrote the
yes.
letter. And then also one of his colleagues, who is a friend, you know, who is one of the doctors who I have worked well with, came up and said, I never even brought it up to him. You know, he just said, oh, I saw that you were in the emergency room. And I said, yes, it was unfortunate that you weren't there because I requested you. And then I told him that I thought his colleague, you know, the way he treated the nurse that was taking care of me and so forth. And he said, well, you know, everybody has a bad day. And I said, you know what? I never treat people that way. I said, I don't take my, you know, just because I'm having a bad day, I'm not going to take it out on the patient, you know? I said, you know, he had his professional conduct. And so whether he went back and said anything to, you know, one of his colleagues, but, you know,
right.
It's like, well, you know, as when then he went on to tell me about, well, you know, with this health care reform and so forth, you know, it's going to, the hospital health care is going to be like the post office.
Right.
And I go, what does that have to do with
it? One of the questions is the classic case, in a way, you know, when you have to look at it and suggest what your desired outcome is. There's a variety of outcomes you may wish. One of them is a catharsis, maybe for yourself, kind of getting it off your chest, and that's a valid outcome. Another is to perhaps change some awareness of the whole group of this physician.
That would be mine, to make them aware of the way they came across.
Another would be to change the behavior of that particular physician for future patients. Another would be to change that physician's behavior towards you in the future. And if you kind of look and sort among those outcomes and pick out the ones that are most important for you, and focus your energy on what you're doing about that outcome. Maybe the writing of the letter was helpful cathartically. Okay, you got it out off your chest. But from the anger that I hear, there may be some more desired outcomes you want. You may want to have that behavior changed for other people or yourself in the future, in which case it sounds to me like you got to decide whether you're willing to take the energy and make the effort to.
I understand.
Yeah. You want to do my session tomorrow? It's about deciding on interests. That's right. That's precisely part of what I want to do tomorrow, which is to talk about understanding people's interests. And when you understand interests, then your own interests better, more complexly. This, I think, by the way, is another thing that would be very useful for people in conversation over the human sexuality thing to do, is to say, what are the variety of outcomes that we're interested in getting from this? Instead of just going in and hammering away at each other. So first saying that, and what you might find is that on some of those outcomes, the two sides can agree, and on some of the and on other of the outcomes, the two sides cannot agree. But if all you do is go in and fight, you miss the chance to find some shared. Maybe I'm wrong about tomorrow. It might be that it's the third session where I'm going to talk about interests. I'm doing escalation soon. I'll have to go back up and look in the kiosk, see what my life is like.
Even in respect to this woman with this hospital situation, can you do something as an employee of the hospital, at least starting with your own profession of nursing, and whether it's, you can have some seminars or forums concerning
we've had those
treatment of patients?
Yeah.
We've had those go on all the time.
How about the quality review board?
I think in all workplaces there's those kinds of trying to work together in collaboration.
Right.
And
that's right. It's just an issue of how much energy you want to do and to pick the goal that you're, that will, and the goal might be to go sit in the jacuzzi for
I'm
a
here
while.
At Holden now, so I don't have to deal with that. I deal with other kinds of issues here.
There you go. Well, we are out of time. Thank you very much. This is a lot of fun. You know, I forgot I was going to have them make an announcement at lunch about the slideshow this evening, because I don't want folks to come to it and then get upset, because there are some very severe racial stereotypes that show up in these posters. I think I'll have to do that like they do on the television show at the very beginning.
Yeah.
Do a disclaimer at the beginning. If you want to leave now, I'll shut my eyes. And